In the 1930s, the liberals had the program of broad social reforms and a crusading spirit. They advocated a planned society. They talked in terms of abstract principles. They propounded theories of a predominantly socialistic nature, and most of them were touchy about the accusation that they were enlarging the government's power. Most of them were assuring their opponents that government power was only a temporary means to an end, a noble end, the liberation of the individual from his bondage to material needs, or so they said. Today, nobody talks of a planned society in the liberal camp. Long-range programs, theories, principles, abstractions, and noble ends are not fashionable any longer. Modern liberals deride any political concern with such large-scale matters as an entire society or an economy as a whole. They concern themselves with single, concrete-bound, range-of-the-moment projects and demands without regard to cost, context, or consequences. Pragmatic, not idealistic, is their favorite adjective when they are called upon to justify their stance, as they call it, not stand. They are militantly opposed to political philosophy. They denounce political concepts as tags, labels, myths, illusions, and resist any attempt to label, that is, to identify their own views. They are belligerently anti-theoretical and, with a faded mantle of intellectuality still clinging to their shoulders, they are anti-intellectual. The only remnant of their former idealism is a tired, cynical, ritualistic quoting of shop-worn humanitarian slogans when the occasion demanded. Cynicism, uncertainty, and fear are the insignia of the culture which they are still dominating by default. And the only thing that has not rusted in their ideological equipment, but has grown savagely brighter and clearer through the years, is their lust for power, for an autocratic, statist, totalitarian government power. It is not a crusading brightness. It is not the lust of a fanatic with a mission. It is more like the glassy-eyed brightness of a somnambulist, whose stuporous despair has long since swallowed the memory of his purpose, but who still clings to his mystic weapon in the stubborn belief that there ought to be a law, that everything will be all right if only somebody will pass a law, that every problem can be solved by the magic power of brute force. Such is the present intellectual state and ideological trend of our culture. Now, I shall ask you to consider the question I raised at the beginning of this discussion. Which of these two variants of statism are we moving towards, socialism or fascism? Let me submit in evidence, as part of the answer, a quotation from a very liberal editorial which appeared in the Washington Star in October 1964. It is an eloquent mixture of truth and misinformation, and a typical example of the state of today's political knowledge. Quote, "Socialism is quite simply the state ownership of the means of production. This has never been proposed by a major party candidate for the presidency and is not now proposed by Lyndon Johnson." True. There is, however, a whole series of American legislative acts that increase either government regulation of private business or government responsibility for individual welfare. True. It is to such legislation that warning cries of socialism refer. Besides the constitutional provision for federal regulation of interstate commerce, such intrusion of government into the marketplace begins with the antitrust laws. Very true. To them, we owe the continued existence of competitive capitalism and the non-arrival of cartel capitalism. Untrue. Inasmuch as socialism is the product, one way or another, of cartel capitalism, untrue, it may reasonably be said that such government interference with business has, in fact, prevented socialism. Worse than untrue. the quote. As to welfare legislation, it is still light years away from the cradle-to-grave security sponsored by contemporary socialism. Not quite true. It seems much more like ordinary human concern for human distress than like an ideological program of any kind. Unquote. The last part of this sentence is true. It is not an ideological program. As to the first part, ordinary human concern for human distress does not manifest itself ordinarily in the form of a gun aimed at the wallets and earnings of one's neighbors. This editorial did not mention, of course, that a system in which the government does not nationalize the means of production, but assumes total control over the economy, is fascism. Here's another piece of evidence. This one is less crudely naive than the first and much more insidiously wrong. This is from a letter to the New York Times on November 1st, 1964, written by an assistant professor of economics. Quote, viewed by almost every yardstick, the United States today is more committed to private enterprise than probably any other industrial country and is not even remotely approaching a socialist system. As the term is understood by students of comparative economic systems and others who do not use it loosely, socialism is identified with extensive nationalization, a dominant public sector, a strong cooperative movement, egalitarian income distribution, a total welfare state, and central planning. In the United States, not only has there been no nationalization, but government concerns have been turned over to private enterprise. Income distribution in this country is one of the most unequal among the developed nations, and tax cuts and tax loopholes have blunted the moderate progressivity of our tax structure. 30 years after the New Deal, the United States has a very limited welfare state compared with the comprehensive social security and public housing schemes in many European countries. By no stretch of the imagination is the real issue in this campaign a choice between capitalism and socialism, or between a free and a planned economy. The issue is about two differing concepts of the role of government within the framework of an essentially private enterprise system. Unquote. I hope you are not applauding this quotation, but if you are, I am just about to pick it up. The role of government in a private enterprise system is that of a policeman who protects men's individual rights, including property rights, by protecting men from physical violence. In a free economy, the government does not control, regulate, coerce, or interfere with men's economic activities. I do not know the political views of the writer of that letter. He may be a liberal, or he may be an alleged defender of capitalism. But if he is this last, then I must point out that such views as his are more damaging and derogatory to capitalism than the ideas of its avowed enemies. He regards capitalism as a system compatible with government controls, and thus helps to spread the most dangerous misconceptions. While full laissez-faire capitalism has not yet existed anywhere, while some unnecessary government controls were allowed to dilute and undercut the original American system, more through error than through theoretical intention, this professor should not permit himself to ignore the fact that the principles, the theory, and the actual working of capitalism rest on a free, unregulated market, as the history of the last two centuries has amply demonstrated. He should not permit himself to ignore the exact meaning of the term laissez-faire and of the term mixed economy, which clearly indicates the two opposite elements involved in the mixture: the element of economic freedom, which is capitalism, and the element of government controls, which is statism. There is an insistent campaign today to make us accept the Marxist view that all governments are tools of economic class interests and that capitalism is not a free economy but a system of government controls serving some privileged class. The purpose of that campaign is to distort economics, rewrite history, and obliterate the possibility and the existence of a free country and an uncontrolled economy. Since a system of nominal private property ruled by government controls is not capitalism, but fascism, the only choice this obliteration would leave us is the choice between fascism and socialism, which all the statists in the world of all varieties, degrees, and denominations are struggling frantically to make us believe. It is thus that the views of that professor, which are shared in various degrees by most conservatives, lend credence and support to the vicious leftist propaganda which equates capitalism with fascism and howls that fascism is a movement of the political right. But there is a bitter kind of justice in the logic of events. That propaganda is having an effect which may be advantageous to the communists, but which is the opposite of the effect intended by the liberals, the welfare statists, the socialists, who share the guilt of spreading it. Instead of smearing capitalism, that propaganda has succeeded in whitewashing fascism. In this country, few people care to advocate, to defend, or even to understand capitalism. Yet fewer still wish to give up its advantages. So if they are told that capitalism is compatible with controls, with the particular controls which they think further their particular interests, be it government handouts or minimum wages or price supports or subsidies or antitrust laws or censorship of dirty movies, they will go along with such programs in the comforting belief that the results will be nothing worse than a modified capitalism. And thus, a country which does abhor fascism is moving by imperceptible degrees through ignorance, confusion, evasion, moral cowardice, and intellectual default, not toward socialism or any mawkish altruistic ideal, but toward the plain, brutal, predatory, power-grabbing, de facto fascism. No, we have not reached that stage. But we are certainly not an essentially private enterprise system any longer. At present, we are a disintegrating, unsound, precariously unstable mixed economy, a random mongrel mixture of socialistic schemes, communistic influences, fascist controls, fascist centralization of power, and shrinking remnants of capitalism, still paying the cost of it all. The total of it rolling not by plan or conspiracy, but by default and necessity, the necessity of an uncontested mixed economy in the direction of a fascist state. Consider our present administration. I don't think I'll be accused of unfairness if I say that President Johnson is not a philosophical thinker. No, he is not a fascist, he is not a socialist, he is not a pro-capitalist. Ideologically, he is not anything in particular. Judging by his past record and by the consensus of his own supporters, the concept of an ideology is not applicable in his case. He is a politician. A very dangerous, yet very appropriate phenomenon in our present state. He is an almost fiction-like, archetypical embodiment of the perfect leader of a mixed economy. A man who enjoys power for power's sake, who is expert at the game of manipulating pressure groups, of playing them all against one another, who loves the process of dispensing smiles, frowns, and favors, particularly sudden favors, and whose vision does not extend beyond the range of the next election. Can you see President Johnson as a socializer of industry? Like all his predecessors in office, Mr. Johnson knows that businessmen are the milch cows of a mixed economy, and he does not want to destroy them. He wants them to prosper and to feed his welfare project, which the next election requires, while they, the businessmen, are eating out of his hand, which they seem to be anxiously eager to do. The business lobby is certain to get its fair share of influence and of recognition, just like the labor lobby or the farm lobby or the lobby of any major segment, at his own pleasure and on his own terms. He will be particularly adept at the task of creating and encouraging the type of businessman whom I call the aristocracy of pool. This is not a socialistic pattern. It is the typical pattern of fascism. A substantial number of Republican businessmen switched to the side of Mr. Johnson in the last election. Here are some interesting observations on this subject from a survey by the New York Times of September 16, 1964. Quote, interviews in five cities in the industrial Northeast and Midwest disclose striking differences in political outlook between officials of large corporations and men who operate smaller businesses. The business executives who expect to cast the first Democratic presidential vote of their lives are nearly all affiliated with large companies. There is more support for President Johnson among business executives who are in their 40s and 50s than there is among either older or younger businessmen. Many businessmen in their 40s and 50s say they find relatively little shifting toward support of Mr. Johnson on the part of younger business executives. Interviews with those in their 30s confirm this. The younger executives themselves speak with pride of their generation as the one that interrupted and reversed the trend toward more liberalism in younger persons. It is on the issue of government deficits that the division of opinion between small and large businessmen emerges most dramatically. Officials of giant corporations have a far greater tendency to accept the idea that budget deficits are sometimes necessary and even desirable. The typical small businessman, however, reserves a very special scorn for deficit spending. Unquote. Does this give you an indication of who are the vested interests in a mixed economy and what such an economy does to the beginners or the young? The particular form of economic organization, which is becoming more and more apparent in this country, as an outgrowth of the power of pressure groups, is one of the worst variants of statism, guild socialism. Guild socialism robs the talented young of their future by freezing men into professional castes. It represents an open embodiment of the basic motives of most statists, though they usually prefer not to confess it, the entrenchment and protection of mediocrity from abler competitors, the shackling of the men of superior ability down to the mean average of their professions. That system is not too popular among socialists, though it has its advocates. But the most famous instance of its practical, large-scale application was fascist Italy. In the 1930s, a few perceptive men said that Roosevelt's New Deal was a form of guild socialism and that it was closer to Mussolini's system than to any other. They were ignored. Today, the evidence is unmistakable. It was also said in the 30s that if fascism ever came to the United States, it would come disguised as socialism. In this connection, I recommend that you read or reread Sinclair Lewis's It Can't Happen Here, with special reference to the character style and ideology of Brazilius Windrip, the fascist leader. Now, let me mention and answer some of the standard objections by which today's liberals attempt to camouflage the nature of the system they are creating. Quote, fascism requires one-party rule, unquote. Well, what do you think the notion of government by consensus will amount to in practice? Quote, fascism's goal is the conquest of the world, unquote. What do you suppose is the goal of the global-minded bipartisan champions of the United Nations? And if they reach it, what positions do they expect to acquire in the power structure of one world? Quote, fascism preaches racism, unquote. Not necessarily. Hitler's Germany did. Mussolini's Italy did not. Quote, fascism is opposed to the welfare state, unquote. Check your premises and your history books. The father and originator of the welfare state, the man who put into practice the notion of buying the loyalty of some groups with money extorted from others, was Bismarck, the political ancestor of Hitler. Let me remind you that the full title of the Nazi Party was the National Socialist Workers' Party of Germany. Let me remind you also of some excerpts from the political program of that party adopted in Munich on February 24, 1920. Quote, we ask that the government undertake the obligation above all of providing citizens with adequate opportunity for employment and earning a living. The activities of the individual must not be allowed to clash with the interests of the community, but must take place within its confines and be for the good of all. Therefore, we demand an end to the power of the financial interests. We demand profit sharing in big business. We demand the broad extension of care for the aged. We demand the greatest possible consideration of small businesses in the purchases of the national, state, and municipal governments. In order to make possible to every capable and industrious citizen the attainment of higher education and thus the achievement of a post of leadership, the government must provide an all-around enlargement of our entire system of public education. We demand the education at government expense of gifted children of poor parents. The government must undertake the improvement of public health by protecting mother and child, by prohibiting child labor, by the greatest possible support for all clubs concerned with the physical education of youth. We combat the materialistic spirit within and without us and are convinced that a permanent recovery of our people can only proceed from within, on the foundation of the common good before the individual good, unquote. This is from the original program of the National Socialist Workers' Party of Germany. For many more quotations of this kind, revealing the altruist collectivist base of the Nazi and fascist ideology, I will refer you to the lecture I delivered at this forum about 2 years ago, entitled The Fascist New Frontier. There is, however, one difference between the type of fascism toward which we are drifting and the type that ravaged European countries. Ours is not a militant kind of fascism, not an organized movement of shrill demagogues, bloody thugs, hysterical third-rate intellectuals, and juvenile delinquents. Ours is a tired, worn, cynical fascism, fascism by default, by moral cowardice, not like a flaming disaster, but more like the quiet collapse of a lethargic body slowly eaten by internal corruption. Did it have to happen? No. Can it still be averted? Yes. Ladies and gentlemen, if any of you doubt the power of philosophy to set the course and shape the destiny of human societies, observe that our mixed economy is the literal, faithfully carried out product of pragmatism and of the generation brought up under its influence. Pragmatism is the philosophy which holds that there is no objective reality, no permanent truth, No absolute principles, no valid abstractions, no firm concepts, that anything may be tried by rule of thumb, that knowledge is to be gained by means of public polls among special elites of competent investigators, that objectivity consists of collective subjectivism, that whatever people wish to be true is true, whatever people wish to exist does exist, provided a consensus says so. If you want to avert the final disaster, it is this type of thinking, every one of those propositions and all of them, that you must face, grasp, and reject. Then you will have grasped the connection of philosophy to politics and to the daily events of your lives. Then you will have learned that no society is better than its philosophical foundation. And then, to paraphrase John Galt, you will be ready not to return to capitalism, but to discover it. Thank you.